You're listening to the UCB Longform Conversations podcast, in-depth conversations with performers and teachers from the best alternative comedy theater on the planet. This podcast is modeled on the improv form La Ronde, so the guest of our last episode becomes the host of this episode, and today's guest will become the host of our next episode. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center.
Warning. What you're about to hear is an extremely nerdy conversation about long-form improv comedy.
Welcome to the UCB Long-Form Conversations Podcast from Los Angeles. I'm Bhuvanesh Singh. I was the guest on the last episode, but today I'm the host. And my guest today is Billy Merritt, who improv fans almost certainly know for many things. Might know from The Swarm, The Stepfathers, the original UCB days, probably several different improv principles and forms that you have heard of or been taught, many different innovations over the years.
I'm responsible for many things.
He's responsible for many things, which we'll be getting into. Welcome to the show, Billy.
Thank you for having me. This is fun.
Yeah,
I'm very excited. I love the podcast studio here.
Yeah, it's very cool.
I love what you've done.
Oh, thank you.
What is that, padding?
That's padding.
Okay.
That's a lamp.
I think that's about it.
Yeah, we're in a padded cell doing an interview. So Billy, we're gonna skip very quickly over the bio stuff because I think if you are interested in Billy's background, there are a number of podcasts that he's done where you can hear in detail some of that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I'm willing to talk about it. It's just I've done it so many times.
Great. Let's just for very quick purposes, just so they have an idea of it.
Sure.
You've been around since the original starting days of the UCB
Theater. Yes, before it was a theater, they did workshops at a little place called Solo Arts Theater.
Okay,
fourth floor walk up.
And what were those days? I mean, I guess my question about it is, was there already sort of a guiding philosophy that they had?
At that time, yeah. I mean, me and Michael Delaney and a couple other people who were at a theater called the National Improv Theater before it went defunct. Turned out they were Scientologists. There's nothing wrong with that, but we didn't know. We were looking for Chicago-styled long-form improv, literally long-form improv, more importantly, the Herald, because nobody in New York that we knew of was teaching that. And they were the first people we knew that had the creds to teach it. Mm-hmm. We had other people teach it that maybe they shouldn't have been teaching it. And I guess we just adopted their – I didn't see a UCB technique. I saw four – what I found amazing was four completely different styles, Amy, Matt Walsh, Matt Besser, and Ian Roberts, yet they all – work together so well.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, finding the game of the scene was their connecting point.
Yes.
But they came from so many different schools of thought. You know, so it just kind of, to me, it became a melting pot form where it's like you can take this and that. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what The Swarm was. We were from different schools.
Right.
But we all agree on the game of the scene and that technique. And that made us work together as a group. So that was like the unifying force for us.
And was The Swarm the first group that was that you were on?
No. There's been so many with so many bad names. In New York, our first group, the Michael Delaney, Dave Blumenfeld, and I, who were all on The Swarm originally, were on a group called Lost Footage. Wonderful name. It came to, I believe, Delaney's wife in a dream that we would be called Lost Footage. And then I think we dabbled with a group called Naked Apartment.
Okay.
And then from there... that's when different people from different groups all gathered and became The Swarm. Mm.
How would you describe does The Swarm have like an ethos or a
style?
A style.
Ethos is adorable.
I mean, I guess I mean like the, yeah. more
no,
than even a style.
Saying.
Do you guys have like an ideology that you're all from?
I absolutely believe that. It's slow play. We don't have to have a game at the beginning of the scene. We know we will get one at some point in time in the scene.
Interesting.
It's really neat. We've noticed we still do myself, Sean Conroy, Andy Secunda, and Andy Daly out here in L.A. do a once-a-month show. And we kind of have to remind ourselves, you know, we don't have to jump out there with an idea like a premise right away. We can just go out there and feel the space and then find the scene that way. And I think that style came to us by doing the mono scene. We were kind of the first group legendarily calling it the mono scene, but the 30-minute improvised scene has lasted, has been around for millions of years, since caveman times, Drew.
Oh, yeah.
Early caveman mono scenes. But we found by doing that form, you had to take it easy, rest in your scene, really get that reality base of who you are and where you are and what's going on in the scene, and then let the game come to you as opposed to coming out there with an idea for game or premise right away. So that seems to be the swarm style, a little bit slower to the game, but getting to the game. And then massive connections, connections we don't expect, hopefully.
Yeah. That's something I've noticed watching swarm shows is that, I mean, I know the name didn't come from this, but watching a swarm show, I feel like at the end of it, the final 10 minutes feel like a swarm of ideas or sort of like almost like insects above everyone's heads. And then you guys are plucking at them one by one. And
That's nice. I like that.
I really have felt, and multiple swarm shows, I've had that weird feeling. And it's a very cerebral swarm of ideas. It feels like a bunch of ideas.
Connecting games as much as it is connecting different philosophies or different points of view.
Yeah, exactly.
Or just different words, you know. that came from – the name The Swarm actually came from – Amy was our first director, and we famously destroyed a form she wanted us to do. And it was a – this is before we were even doing Heralds. And it was a I don't even know how to describe it. It's a kind of a here's what she did. We had our first meeting at her place, and she handed us cassette tapes of Wu-Tang Clan. So this is how long ago it was. There were cassette tapes. And Wu-Tang Clan was a new band we hadn't heard of before. And she wanted to create a form that involved mixing of scenes, just like mixing of songs, taking a line or a philosophy from this scene and a line or philosophy from that scene, and then later mixing it. There was a exercise in the middle of that where we would literally yell, "Let's break it down!" and we'd jump out on stage and immediately list like a scenic layering or painting a picture of a character on stage. And she would literally say, swarm it, get in there, get all involved in the, you know, that process. And it seemed to be the one thing we were good at of that form. We were not rappers. We didn't have that funk. But we definitely had a good connection with each other.
Yeah.
And we knew we wanted to do Heralds and eventually became a Herald team from that. And I guess that's where the name came from. It was like the one thing we were good at in Amy's
swarming.
Eyes. Yeah.
What when it comes to those skills you listed, or not even skills, that sort of thing of like, we're really investing, you know, when you do a mono scene, we're really investing in building the reality and
yeah.
the attention. Is that some? How do you take that same philosophy or approach and bring it to the much more constrained form of a Herald where it's shorter scenes?
Yeah, I spend a lot of my time teaching that now. Keep even in advance, go back to your reality base. Is it truthful? Is it real right up front? Right. And I will say the first minute. It's not the first minute, but you have to say something. Sometimes in the first two lines of dialogue, you're in a truthful, real, grounded scene, and you know where you're coming from. Obviously, with groups who know each other better, they can get to it sooner. But really knowing that you can take a breath in that first minute and know who you are and where you are and let the premise come out of that, as opposed to immediately attacking a premise right away. If the first line out of your mouth is going to be a premise line or a joke line, then you're just kind of, you're peddling backwards a little. You know, you're trying to catch up with the scene.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, yeah, it's all about taking that breath. I was comparing it to rookies playing basketball or football. It's like that your first year, everything is so fast. But by your second and third year, and as you become a veteran, everything starts to slow down a little bit more. And you know you have the time to build up from there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does.
Yeah.
To sort of extend that analogy into into another question.
Ooh.
When you, you know, when I guess just you saying that reminded me of something I read of Michael Jordan's trainer, this guy Tim Grover, was talking about how when it came to being on the court, Jordan had an uncanny ability to only be focused on the ball, and he would talk about that. You know, like where, everything else, the audience, the crowds would fall away from his focus. Everything was about, he would be so focused on the ball.
Yeah.
When it comes to improv, like when you're doing a show, what's the ball for you?
The ball is the scene. You want to get to that point on stage where this is interesting because it is long form improv is empathy connection with you and your scene partner in a scene, but also the audience. The audience goes, I've been there. I've seen that.
Yeah.
That's why you want that reality base, that truthful moment in a scene. But you want to be able to connect with your audience and then forget the audience isn't even there. You know, the old theater term is the fourth wall.
Right.
Hiding behind the fourth wall, or the audience is literally leaning out of their seats and looking into the scene, bringing them in. Mm-hmm. And when you're in a zone, you forget the audience is even there.
Yeah. And how do you get yourself there? Just with reps? Just you do it so much that you
I guess
forget?
It's reps or work with who you like. It's interesting, you know. I'm more attuned to when I'm not in there than when I'm in. It's like if I'm in the zone, I'm not aware of it. But if I'm starting to pay attention to anything on the outside, people in the audience, I know some people really get worked up if somebody in the audience is loud or noisy or has a weird laugh, and it kind of takes them out of their comfort zone. Whereas I'm more, I don't want to hear it. You know, I be as loud as you want. Let me not hear it. Does that make sense?
Like, yeah.
How more focused I can be. Mm-hmm. Another example of that would be like if somebody somebody important comes to the audience. You know, there are some people in your group that don't want to know that they're there, mm-hmm. and they're like, for me, it's like, yeah, tell me that they're there because I'm going to try harder to ignore them. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, it's a motivation for me to really focus on the game even more. Mm. Also, when you do that, you start to listen less to the laughter and, you know, because there are sometimes you have to pause for laughter. But then there are other times if you get really good at it, the audience forgets to laugh. Does that make sense? They're just following the scene.
Yeah.
You know, and it's they'll laugh afterwards. Does that make sense?
That does make sense.
I'm going to keep saying, does that make sense?
That makes sense.
Yeah.
That's a good catchphrase, though, for the episode. Every episode apparently has had a catchphrase.
Oh, really? What was our catchphrase?
Does that make sense?
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Also, don't try the shrimp burrito. Ugh,
oh, yeah.
That was problem.
The backstory to that is just before this interview, Billy ate a shrimp burrito that he's regretting, it seems.
No, it's okay. It's just, you know, when you go to a Pollo Loco, get the Pollo.
Yeah.
That's my bad.
So when it comes to, when it is, when you talk about, like, the laughs of an audience. When it comes to a show, so if it's not the laughter, do you quantify, and if so, how do you quantify whether it's a good show or a bad show?
That's interesting because I think if you have seven people on stage and you ask all seven in an isolated booth, was it a good show or was it a bad show? I'm not going to say it's going to be half and half, but there's always going to be one or two people to go,
yeah.
Another part. My favorite is walking off stage going, that was great, right? No? Oh, yeah. Okay. So it's really I want to say that I'm there, but I would like to be able to, like, every show, once you walk off, that's it. We've did it. It's fine.
Right.
Move on.
So you don't worry about that label on it.
We hit when the Swarm hit its stride, I'd say there was about 5 years for our Friday shows that we were just – every show – was just we were knocking it out of the park, you know. And it's not to brag. It was just like we were literally going, God damn, what did we do? What's going on? And we would, after the show, go to the Bart McManus and discuss the show in a sense of you were great doing this, you were great doing that. But we were really just trying to figure out what was it that we were doing. It started out as praise, but it became more I think we were realizing we were doing a thing called an Atomic Herald, which isn't a real thing. It's basically we were discovering a form on our feet every night. And we didn't know we were doing that. We just started doing that. And that's like we had to step afterwards. And at that time, we didn't have a coach, so we were not giving each other notes, but through praise. And wow, that was an awesome move, and that was a great connection. We were giving each other notes.
Yeah, but only positive notes.
Yeah, only positive notes. And I would say during that moment, that time, there were no bad shows, you know. Although Dave always walked off and thought everything sucked, but that was Dave, and everything was fine with that. I don't know if I necessarily – do that now. Every now and then I walk off and either my feelings were hurt or I could do better or, wow, I was really good. So it's kind of as I've gotten maybe a little bit older and not as on mark.
Yeah.
Because I don't play as much as I used to. I was playing every night. So now I become a little more judgmental than I was when I was in my prime.
Yeah, when you're playing every night, every show, it doesn't matter. You have another one the next day. You're
exactly,
fine.
Exactly.
What I mean, what do you think from your own sort of journey in improv, and also having worked with so many students and shepherding young improvisers? What's the best way to get better? It's a very general question.
You know what? I've changed that point of view. I used to say consistently 10,000 hours, which everybody's heard and knows from the Blink book and all that. And now, especially now that the indie scene has exploded to the size it is now, I'm almost seeing people hurt themselves by how much they're playing.
Yeah.
In a sense that they'll do shows for two or three other improvisers and all their scenes would be either inside jokes or they'll reinforce that bad habit that they had before.
Right.
So I'm kind of changing my mind on that. And it's like, have the mindset of 10,000 hours up to a point, then pick the group you want to work with and work on one thing.
With that crew.
Find that crew. Yeah, your squad, I believe the kids are calling it now. Your squad. The very first comedy group I was in, Comedy Squad. That was the name.
Oh, really?
Me and Michael Delaney were in the
before
comedy
it's time.
Squad. Yeah. Way before it's time.
That's good.
So
that makes sense, yeah.
It's like once you get it, you've got to get with that group because it's not a solo adventure. You have to work with your crew to get better, and you have to trust everybody so that you're not even thinking that anybody could be doing anything wrong or that you could be doing anything wrong or you think that they think you could be doing anything wrong. And then you guys are all vulnerable enough to learn and grow. Then pick a form, one form. Do that form, nail it. Then pick another form and another form. And then once you feel you've mastered 10 to 20 forms or something like that, then quit doing forms. Do montages and see what happens. I think that's what the Smokes did. I know that's what the Smokes did because I made us do that.
Yeah, and so. That's a good point. Yeah, I've heard you mention form before versus just going out and doing a random wash of scenes.
Yeah.
I mean, what are the benefits of doing a form?
Form is structure, just like game is structure and scene is structure. A herald is like a scene is like a mini herald if you can really beat it out properly and write it out. Form is constantly teaching you to work on one side of your brain while doing the other side of your brain. Form and function. If you're just doing scenes, montage scenes, you're going to go out and you're going to be funny if you're funny. And you're going to be funny and you're going to be funny. But you're not going to really work on structure and connections.
Yeah.
In different forms. For instance, this show is a Laron. And I teach Laron in class completely different than a performance Laron. It's different ways of doing it. But it teaches you to mold one idea to the next idea and how things just flow together until they connect versus a form like the movie, which teaches you a very distinct stage presence in moves and also genre play and able to use references and make them more personal in that moment in time. Instead of you're not just doing Jaws, you're living in the world of Jaws. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I think
you're saying like the genre is the reality.
Yeah. And you were in that class, right?
Yes.
Improvise 1X? When you showed up.
No, I was in the movie class.
The movie class?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Were you in my Improvise 1X?
I was not, no.
You should have been.
I should be. And weirdly, I'm actually coaching a group right now that all took your class.
Oh, really?
So we've been working on Improvise 1X.
Yeah. Oh, the idea behind that, and it's the same as the movie, is like learn Tennessee Williams so that the first few times you do it, all your comedy will be doing Tennessee Williams.
Doing it well.
Doing it well and the Southern accents and making jokes about, a cat on a hot tin roof and all those references. Then once you get past that, you're using the playwright and how he wrote with your improv. So, for instance, Tennessee Williams was big on object monologues. And it's like, using objects on stage and talking about things, maybe even off stage, like that tire swing over there is a lot like us. You can tie things together a little bit better using that playwright.
Yeah.
So that's what you do with a movie, with genres. Right.
What I mean, well, this is something else that relates to something I've heard you say a lot, which is, you know, you advise improvisers to consume story.
Yeah.
A lot. One question is, how has that sort of informed your improv? Different media, movies, documentaries.
Well, you'll be in a scene, and you're in the middle of the scene, and you're going, well, this feels like, right now I'm doing Books on Tape. I'm trying really hard with the Books on Tape. I keep falling asleep. I'm listening to a story right now called Hyperion. Mm-hmm. It's a sci-fi. It's like one of those top sci-fi stories I've never read or heard. So I'm listening to it now, and I'm going, this is a lot like this story or that story. It's about six people going on an adventure in space or something right. like that. But that reference reminds me of another story that's like that. That is another story is like that. Imagine being in a scene. I was just mentioning Jaws before. I was like, this feels like that scene where Quinn is in the back scratching his nails on the chalkboard.
We got to get a bigger boat.
Yeah, we got to get a bigger boat. No, I'll get your shark for you. Right. I'm the man.
Right.
But it's like, it feels like that, but we're at a PTA meeting. You know, or something like that.
Yeah.
So you have the scene structure idea, but you can put that into any structure. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
That does
or
make
any,
sense. Yeah.
Any world.
Yeah.
So like when you're in the middle of a scene, this feels like a Sound of Music moment or something like that. That doesn't mean you're referencing Sound of Music. You're not making your comedy about references, but you're using what they used in Sound of Music or, you know, that idea.
Yeah.
And that's just anything you can do to help you, man.
Yeah.
Anything to get you going on stage.
What does get you going these days? Why do you still do it?
I don't know. Oh, geez. I get re-excited every few years. Last year, my big excitement was traveling and going to workshops. It started with going to a workshop in Omaha.
To teach
a workshop, and it was like an improv festival, and it's like, wow, these communities are growing everywhere. It's not LA, it's not New York. Mm-hmm. And then that took me to Seattle, then Miami, then New York for the Del Close Marathon, then London, and I'm just seeing all these communities grow, and that's clearly reinvigorated me as far as teaching. Mm-hmm. And going and traveling and doing shows with all these other people.
Yeah.
On stage, it's the Del Close Marathon's coming up, so that gets me motivated. But like playing with the Smokes is straight up just partying with my friends,
right?
You know, we try to do the right thing on stage, and it's a good show. It's a lot of fun. Do we break a few rules? Sure, why not? My big problem now is laughing on stage. That was never a problem with me in the past.
You're just having more fun.
I'm having a little more fun. So I'm playing because I love it as opposed to playing because I got to get better at it.
Right.
You know, I will catch myself every now and then, like I said, walking off stage going, that was, how did I not see that? You know, and I'll get angry with myself and then I'll move on.
Yeah.
With the Swarm, we did something we haven't done in 18 years, and that's now we have friends. Sit in with us. Mm-hmm. And now that's all of a sudden changed the dynamic and made it much more interesting and fun. Having people sit in and play our style and us trying to remember what our style was.
Yeah.
Because we only meet once a month now. And so that's a different style and that's a lot of fun. So I guess I'm at the point where it's like, I just want to do it if I'm having fun. I don't need to do it because I have to do it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I said before, I was doing it every night, anywhere, anyhow, any show, let me in. Now it's like, well, I'll do that. That seems like fun.
That's great. And what are your biggest pet peeves with improv?
So many jokes here. Like I said, laughing. You know what? Here's a pet peeve. Laughing extra loud on the back wall to let the audience know that whatever's going on stage is funny. Mm-hmm. Like, so whatever's happening on stage, and you're on the back wall going, that's funny. The audience doesn't appreciate this enough. Ha, ha! And you're, like, a little bit louder.
Yes.
So now the audience has to look at you, enjoy them, do a scene. Yeah. And it's like, no, don't be there.
Right.
You know, be on the back wall. Let's forget that you're even on the back wall. Then right. When you come in,
yes,
you know, that's a little surprise.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's something.
That's something. That's interesting you say that, because I have noticed that where it's such a, it just pulls focus in a way that you don't want it to.
Yeah, yeah. I went off on that with a class earlier. It was about ninja editing.
Uh-huh.
And they took a little too literally. Like, you mean like a real ninja? It's like, no. The idea is kill a scene before it knows it's dead, which
right.
means you should be not, you know, going back and forth on the back wall ready to pounce at any moment like you're a ninja. But just in your head, know anticipate when that scene's going to end so that you're walking across stage almost as they're saying that line that gets that final laugh,
right.
The biggest laugh you could possibly get.
Right.
And it's like making those moves that the audience goes, that was a great move. Who did it? I don't know. You know,
yeah.
That's the way it should be, because it shouldn't be individuals on a team. It should be the team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hopefully that's the idea.
Yeah, that makes sense. That actually leads me to something that you're well known for, which is your pirate robot ninja paradigm.
Sure. Do you have the toys? Did you bring the toys?
Oh yes. They're right here. do you want to briefly sort of explain what that is?
The idea is... we were teaching a style of, you know, you've got to think, but you also have to feel on stage. You have to be this, but also that. In other words, I'm making a motion with my head and my stomach. And it became about the left side of the brain, the right side of the brain. And a lot of teachers use a lot of different verbs. This is back in New York. And I think Delaney was saying Monster and Machine. And I said, that's stupid. It should be Pirate and Robot. That's much more fun because that's the characters we play on stage the most. So the theory behind it is pirate and robot, left side of the brain, right side of the brain. Some of us are more analytical. Some of us are more impulsive. Some of us feel on stage. Some of us just go out there. And the moment they're on stage, they exist and they live and they react to that. That, I would say, would be more on that pirate side of your brain. Mm-hmm. As left side or right side, I'm not too sure. Whatever. And some people are like that, whereas some people tend to think the game through. Some people tend to think about all the moves. They tend to be more of the straight people in the scene or make the moves, or maybe they're the better editors or something along those lines. And the idea behind it was, once you can figure out where you're coming from in your improv, then you can go, okay, I'm more of a pirate because I was a pirate when I was starting, so I own it. Instead of like avoiding it and just to, once you discover who you are, own it and become the master of that, because once you do that, then you can start working on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could become more on that robot or become more analytical. For me, I was having a problem with game because I was making giant big moves that would get laughs. And I was told afterwards that didn't really play the game. And I'm like, I ain't got to laugh. and it's like Del Close says, you don't have to be, just because they're laughing doesn't mean you're doing it right.
Right.
Which I used to bristle at, but now I get it.
Uh-huh.
But once I realized where I was coming from, then I spent about 2 years not really coming out big and broad, but coming off the back wall to support scenes and be more robotic in a sense, like think twice here before you move,
right.
And then make the move that's going to help them and their scene.
Because mm-hmm.
It was never about ego with me. It was more about I'm just doing what I know what to do.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I found that balance between the two where you realize sometimes you need to be more analytical in that scene and play the smartness of it. And sometimes you just need to be a pirate and just throw your ass out there, you know, fall and let figure it out on the way down,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. And the idea is once you master those two things and you achieve balance and you're maintaining balance, then you're a ninja. In other words, you do what you need to do in each and every scene, and you have different roles and different groups that you play in.
Right.
Like in the Smokes, I would feel more setting up scenes because there's such brilliant players there. I go to the shows to watch Neil Casey and Will Hines, and so I'll just lob them whatever I can and watch them do their work, and I have more fun doing that than I would just going out there and being a giant braggadocio, mm-hmm. which I will do every now and then.
Yeah, you got it.
So the idea is find out whether you're a pirate or robot. Are you more analytical? Are you more impulsive? Once you do that, own it. Now work on the other side. Become balanced so you can do what needs to be done in each and every scene.
Mm.
And like I said, each and every group. And then you can start to steer the whole form, not just your own scene. You can make the whole form about something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does. That's actually really interesting because I've never heard you talk. When I've always heard it described, I always thought of it as a triangle of like three separate polarities. But now it seems more like you're saying a pirate and robot both combined make you a ninja.
I shouldn't have said ninja ever. I understand that. I understand that.
No, that's good. Now that makes a lot of sense. When you say the
really you love when people explain it back to me. I heard you do pirate robot. Tell me what that is. I was like, no.
That's not what you mean.
Apparently, I'm not describing it well.
Well, you got to hear an exclusive, perfect description. That's fascinating. What you just said about making the form about something, I want to ask you about that. This is something I know you, I haven't done it firsthand, but Beth Appel, who I interviewed on the last episode, was talking about you being their coach. And something we talked about a little was about theme.
Yes.
And you do emphasize that. It's something I'm really fascinated by because I'm not It seems so ephemeral. How do you define theme in improv, and how do you get it?
Yeah, well, it's the part in your as you develop in your improvisation is don't just pull off a herald, make a herald about something.
Right.
The first time I heard the word herald, I thought it was like angels coming from. You mean like heralding in the truth? And I go, no, it's just a guy named Harold. Oh. But in the back of my mind, it's always has been. And the heralds that have affected me that I've seen have been about something. Kevin Mullaney was one of my best directors that I ever worked with. And he was the last director who worked in The Swarm. He used to mention this all the time to us. And this became the Swarm mantra. Suggestion is opening. Opening is form. Form is not form. And that was the Swarm show. The idea is, once you walk out on stage, the audience gives you an emotion or feeling. You can feel it. You know, have you ever done an exercise where it's just you and another person standing on stage until somebody starts?
Yes.
You're feeling off of each other?
Yeah.
It should be the same thing with your audience. Right. Is when you come out, you can feel an audience is giddy. You can feel an audience is, and that's kind of why we, like in stand-up, you never come out and go, hey, how you doing tonight? Because that's a waste of time. But in improv, I do it because I want to feel what the audience, you know. If I go, how you doing? And they go, yeah! It's like, okay, that's what you're going to get back. But if I go, how you doing? Oh, okay. I was like, all right. Well, you get what you deserve. The idea is you're feeling off the audience, off the suggestion that they're giving you. And then once you get that, your opening should dictate that. And I think I did that with Beth's group and with Bangarang's group. And I really kind of got good at that with those guys is we learned multiple openings. Don't learn one opening. Learn 10 openings. Get your suggestion. Start with, I guess we usually started with pattern game. And then go wherever you want to go. Don't do just one opening. It's like a buffet of openings. So you start out with pattern game. Then you switch over into organic for a while, sound and movement. Then that goes into painting the picture, which goes into monologue, which goes back into pattern game. And it goes wherever it wants to go. And this is the way we did it in The Swarm when we were kind of hitting the heralds, you know, hitting our stride with the heralds, is that we would do an organic opening, but it felt like multiple openings whenever, whatever we needed to do for the opening, we did. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a huge leap for herald teams. So you're not just doing the blank opening, because when you do the blank opening, it feels like, all right, we're done with the opening. Now let's do the herald. And right. It's like, no, it's all one thing. So right. That whatever suggestion is opening, then opening is form. However you did that opening is how you do the form. And I've dealt with many different ways of doing it. One of them is creative or fanciful edits in the middle of a scene. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's the scenes themselves are connected. Sometimes it's object transference where one object goes from one scene to the next scene. It's little things. It's not big things is what I learned about kind of theming or threading a herald.
Yeah.
So
it's not heavy-handed.
Exactly. The more you try to form a herald, the worse it becomes.
Yeah.
And I've found that out through mistakes.
That's interesting.
So little, less is more. And this is where Kevin Mullaney comes in. His suggestion is opening is form. So let's say the form becomes formulaic. It's like you see this herald is about, like this happened once with a group I was coaching where they edited every time with a cougar attack. Okay, that's funny for the first three scenes, but after a while it gets boring.
Right.
And by the third beats, it just is, it's tiring.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's become predictable. So suggestion is opening is form. Form is not form. So the moment they see what your form could be, walk away. Mm-hmm. Get away from that. Mm-hmm. Let them forget about it. Then come back to it again later. So every time you create a pattern, you should be thinking how to break it so you can come back to it, not just how to play it. So the idea with it, herald is hard to formulate. No, I'm not going to say that. I am. The herald is hard to formulate because you're already working on a form, the structure of ABC game.
Right.
But the idea is if you can create form within that structure, you can create form anywhere. When I say form, theme. If you can create a theme within a herald, imagine what you can do with a monoscene or a Laurent or something else like that.
Right.
So that's the idea. And then once you get to that point, then you don't need a form. You discover the form while you're doing the show. And I think we're still kind of doing that now with the smokes. Every now and then, when we're on our game, we always start with a mono scene in the second half. Mm-hmm. And then the mono scene might stay a mono scene, or it might turn into a Laurent, or it might turn into a fractured scene or something along those lines.
Yeah. That's kind of great, because I think that that notion of not of finding the form as it goes makes it the ultimate form of improvisation. You're improvising not just the scenes, but you're improvising the whole shape of the show.
Exactly. That's where you need to go. But in order to get there, you got to put in your faux 10,000 hours
and do form.
The thing that Amy told us with the swarm when we were first put together, it's like, we want to do heralds. Like, how many heralds have you guys done? Oh, probably about 200-300. Great, you got 1,000 more to go. Let's go. Right. And it's like everybody looked at each other, and went, ugh. But she was right. It's like once you get tired of it, you've just started. You know, if you're tired of it, then you need to do better, and not so it's not tiring. You need to do, you know, make the herald better. And there's so many different ways and structures to do that. Mulaney made us do with the French scene herald a lot, which is a mono scene herald
mixed together, all in one.
Mm-hmm. The action movie herald is one I created with a class because they wouldn't move. So, like, every scene has to be in an action movie. So you're in the middle of a fight or in the middle of a gun battle or on a speedboat, but you have to talk about something else. So it's like, yeah, there's so many different ways to do a herald that's going to make you better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to return to that thing you mentioned about, you know, feeling the audience out of the top. Just because something I've been thinking about or I'd like to hear your opinion on is where is that balance between feeling and following your instincts and and a more cerebral approach to it, in the sense that can game be an experiential thing rather than a cerebral thing?
I think, well, that's pirate robot again. I think game is different. Pirates play game different than robots play game. You know, it's not one thing. Yes, it is, but no, it's not. Here's an example. In class, I constantly explain game the same way every single time.
Mm-hmm. Which is what?
Reality-based. Call out the unusual thing, justify the unusual thing. If that, then what else? If that, then what else? If that, then what else? And the idea is, like, that's what I'm looking for you to do in class. Am I expecting you to do that for the rest of your life? No, but you have to have some sort of structure to aim towards or something like that. Mm-hmm. But to say that that's the only way to play game is not true. It's not factual.
Right.
Armando Diaz was, I was talking about the swarm. Amy was our first coach. Armando Diaz was our second coach, and then Kevin Mulaney, our third. Armando, when we started talking about game, and maybe he wasn't necessarily agreed, he was the AD at that time at UCB. Maybe he didn't agree with other members of UCB, but he felt the game is anything that you think it is. If you feel you can latch yourself onto it and build a pattern off of it, it's going to be the game. Mm. And what he's trying to say is, don't sweat it. You know, don't freak out over it. If you feel the game is too, like you said, cerebral, if it's too, then maybe that's not the type of game you should be playing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does.
Sometimes a game is a character. Sometimes a game is, I don't know, done totally in silence. Maybe it's a technique within the scene that's the game. You know, I think there's a lot of, it just opens it up a little bit more.
Yeah.
But you've got to, you can't teach that. You can't say, well, what did you think that was of the game? Well, the game could be, because that's a 10-hour class as opposed to a 3-hour class.
Yeah.
And everybody be rolling their eyes.
Yeah.
Where do you think you come from with game?
I think I'm increasingly thinking more about it being feeling-based or emotion-based.
Do you think instinct or feeling?
I think feeling, more emotion. Because I think, like, it's so much of, like, this is the small backstory because I already did an episode.
That's okay.
Was that I've been hosting this like silent show
It's
all like, but it's written.
Yeah.
But because of that, the reaction from the audience has been so much bigger than I thought it would be at the end of the show, and I think it's because every scene is much simpler, so that the justifications and all that stuff have to be sort of inherent.
Yeah.
You can't do a silent scene where it's a really wordy philosophy of why this person is doing that.
Exactly.
And it's made me go like, oh, when the philosophies are that simple in an improv scene, when it's just emotion, when the audience can read the emotion and say, oh, that's why that character is doing that weird thing.
Exactly.
It's more effective.
Are you promoting that show?
Yes, please come to that show.
When is it?
May 30th, 11 p.m., UCB Franklin.
I'm going to be busy, but good luck. I salute you for doing that, because that's probably the scariest kind of improv for me is because of my mouth is doing. We did a month of Silent Heralds, and it was the scariest time for me.
Yeah.
In a smoke show.
Yeah.
But you remember we were talking about you don't have to wait for the audience to laugh. I think an audience is more enraptured in that. They don't need to laugh to enjoy that show.
Right.
That's what scares me, because I'm not hearing the
you
laughs.
Want the laughs, yeah.
That's a good point. I think that's a great show to promote. Good for you.
But thank you.
Hey, good on you.
Oh, thanks, bro.
Yeah, man.
Very nice. What is your approach to the why of a scene, though? To the what makes a good philosophy?
Oh, everything is why. That's why we do it, man. justification is everything. I've been teaching now, build your second beats and third beats off of justification. Don't build it on anything else. Just build it on the why. Why? Because you're answering a question. The Herald asks a question, you're answering it with that justification. That's another theme, using the justification. So the idea, like an analogous, the first scene is a father and son. The father wants the son to be a mechanic and work in his shop, but the son wants to be an astrophysicist or something stupid like that. The second beat, and he wants to do it because he wants to his dad showed him this world, and now he wants to live this world, you know? So in other words, the dad wanted a better world from him, but he still wanted him to live here in his world. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So that's a great first scene I just talked about. The second beat of that scene, let's take the historical perspective of that, an analogous scene, and let's just – Napoleon popped in my head. His young son, Napoleon Jr.
Great.
and he wants him to conquer these worlds. He wants him to conquer all these nations or something like that. Instead of Napoleon, let's make it just a regular barbarian. Make it open.
Okay.
But the son doesn't want to do that. The son wants to start a religion.
Invent a pastry.
Yeah, invent a pastry.
Napoleon.
No, Drew, you got it all wrong. That's another in class where I said, if you do Napoleon, you have to do a short joke and a pastry,
joke
and get out of there.
Yep.
But the idea is you're theming off the justification
yes,
of
right,
it.
Right,
I'm
right.
doing it, Dad, because you taught me this world. You
right.
show me this world. Now I want to live in a world. It's like, no, you need to stay here and rule the kingdom.
Right.
Now you've themed a show.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, that's interesting. So to you, the theme does come down to the why.
The why is everything. Your answer on stage of dialogue should be, as soon as that person says something in your mind, you're going, why would he say that? Hmm. Oh, he'd say it because of this. That's your line of dialogue.
Interesting.
You know, you should be answering your own personal why, and that would justify and figure everything else out.
Yeah.
Little things like just simple things like, where are we that we're having this conversation?
Right.
Or who is this person I'm talking to?
Right.
Answer it. Hmm. Wow.
That's fascinating.
You want to lie down? Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm gonna do the rest of this horizontally. Talk a little more about that, about the notion of why leading the theme.
Why?
You know, because we talked earlier about stories and how those kind of inform your improv.
Yeah.
Let's take a classical movie, in the classical movie structure, or even in the classical dramatic structure, like, you know, like that Aristotle would talk about, the meaning of a story is revealed often by the transformation, either in the characters or the audience or what we learn, right? The meaning of a story is about, how did they change from the beginning or the end? Or
absolutely.
If they didn't change, that's a different meaning.
Then we're not seeing a story.
It's a tragic story where they didn't change and because of that they suffered and the audience gets some...
Results of the action.
But in any case, that to me somehow seems to connect with the why in an improv show.
Absolutely.
Right?
The why might change that character's philosophy in life right then and there on stage.
Right.
Why not?
You know,
it goes back to the vulnerability note. I love saying vulnerable, but then I hate saying it too much because then everybody on stage is weak and crying.
What does vulnerable mean to you?
Vulnerable means is I heard what you said, and it's like, wow, I'm taking that in. I get what you say. Maybe everything I thought up to this point might be wrong. You know, that could be the situation here in my life. And it goes to the note of every scene we see on stage should be between people who remember that moment with that other person, that character, 20 years from now. So those two characters will remember that moment, even if it's a chance encounter, 20 years from now. How does that happen? Something important happens to one of them somehow, some way.
And they're affected by the other
person. It could be their point of view. It could be the realization that they were wrong this whole time. It could be the realization that they may have thought they were wrong. They were right the whole time.
How does a performer get to that place where they're vulnerable on stage?
You can't force it. That's hard. I mean, like you get on stage and go, be vulnerable, be vulnerable. That's not going to happen. It starts with listening and being affected by listening. What helped me is I was taking acting classes as well as in New York, as well as improv, is one of my I might have been Atlantic Theater or somewhere else where it says acting comes from four parts of your body. Your four centers are your head, your heart, your stomach, your groin. The head is when you're heady in a scene. You're intellectual, like Mamet or Star Trek. Science fiction. The heart is about emotion, about the feels. It's about The Notebook. I don't know. I haven't seen that movie, but I think that works for people.
Watched that yesterday.
Yeah, Tennessee Williams. That's why you look like you've seen The Notebook. I can see it on your forehead.
First time.
Tennessee Williams or something emotional where you get the feels. The stomach is reaction and listening. Coming from the gut.
The gut
and it's like, this is horrible that I use this as an example, but I remember having to take my dog in to be put under, and that was the first time I felt like butterflies in my stomach, not in a good way, but just like that. And it's like, oh, I've had that moment before where somebody close had to go to the hospital, and it kind of hits you in the stomach, and it's reaction. To what you watch. And if you want to use film examples, I use Kurosawa as that example. Any of his, the Blood Throne or Seven Samurai, if somebody says something important in a Kurosawa film, there's one example of the samurai are coming to town and the person goes, "Whoa!" and falls on his ass. It's like, what acting style ever allowed you to fall on your ass when you hear news? And it just extends it so much bigger. So to me, acting core coming from the gut means that gut feeling, that gut reaction. Now, the groin is not sexual all the time. It's instinct. We are the human animal. And sometimes when you hear something, you just naturally, you can't help feeling what you feel, even though you know you shouldn't feel it. So that class helped me with improv, helped me with listening. And for me, it's like a hitting in the gut. You know, that's where I listen to something. So somebody says something to me on stage, I'm going, wow. It's not reacting that time. I'm not reacting that way out loud all the time.
Right.
But on the inside, I am.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully.
Yeah, you're taking it in.
I was explaining this today in class. We're talking about gift giving. And I remember a gift that Pam Murphy gave to me on stage 8 or 9 years ago. And it was one line of dialogue. And we were doing something that had nothing to do with this. And she just casually, non-sequiturly mentioned, well, you do have those three Oscars up there on the wall for sound editing. And I just sat back and went, yeah, I do, don't I? And it's like, I don't remember the rest of the scene. All I remember is like, damn it, I do have three Oscars in one scene.
That's
somewhere. I had three Oscars.
Great gift.
And it just hit me right in the gut. I loved it. Yeah.
That is great. What makes a good performer?
Height. I don't know. There's so many different styles. You can't create the it's not like PlayStation. Oh, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
No, that would be horrible.
Create
that would be long form improv PlayStation.
Game.
Edit. Actually, I would love that. I think it's not what makes a good player. Here, I'm going to get sappy. I think what makes a good team.
Okay.
Like I said, you tend to have people who are more straight people or voice of reason people who are more adventurous and throw themselves out there more. What makes good improv is not one person, but a group of people making choices together. To me, that makes it exciting.
Yeah.
And as varied as the group that can be, that can work together, the more exciting it is to me.
Uh-huh.
And that's when I first saw UCB. The first ASCAT I saw was at a bar. It's like, these four people don't look like they're friends. It's not they were arguing or anything. They just don't look like bros.
They have different points of view.
But once they were on stage, they created these scenes perfectly with each other. And it's like, yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
And I think we hit that a little bit with The Swarm. And it was one of those side notes about this. you don't have to be best friends to be on a good team. Jokingly, when I say Herald teams get together, it's go out, go bowling, be best friends. It's like, no, you just have to have, like, I think in a swarm, I may not see Sean for a month, but we'll continue the same conversation we had a month ago. Right. Time doesn't matter to us. We'll always be bonded and connected to get together,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's like when I was saying those 10,000 hours, find that team, because you're not going to learn it on your own,
yeah.
You know? And if you don't have friends, stand-up would be good for you.
Yeah.
Drew.
Me?
Yeah. What?
Oh.
Nothing. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Get up off the floor.
No. So what's the right way for people coming up?
Mm-hmm.
What's the right way for them to watch shows?
Oh, that's a good question. It depends. Well, you say coming up. In 101, I'm teaching my first 101 in a long time. Great class. I worry that the next time I teach another 101, they're going to suck. But these guys are awesome and wonderful, and I love them to death. For them, I'm asking them to, what about the show surprises you or that you don't understand? Because it's all new to them, to the point where it's like, what's an opening? You know, what
right.
is this? Why did they run across stage? That's called an edit. Versus 401. Where I insist that I want you to watch shows and then tell me what you watched, why you liked it, or why you didn't like it. Like, in other words, watch it, make a decision. Did I like it or did I not like it? And then ask yourself why. Because by 401, you have to make a decision of what kind of improviser you're going to be.
Right.
101, 201, 301, you're nothing. You're dirt. You're learning. You're taking all that information in. Watch everything. And 201, watch Herald's, watch how everything is done. And 301, watch Herald's, watch how it's done. Watch all the styles. Don't have opinions. Just take it all in. And then by 401, and when it's time for you to start teaching yourself, start creating your opinions then.
Hmm.
So you the way you watch improv does evolve as you're learning.
Great.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. And I think this might be our final question.
Awesome.
Why do improv at all?
Oh, follow your fun. I was just talking to somebody about this. It's like you could be doing other things. You could be making more money, or maybe I could be opening that sports bar in Florida any second now. But would I be having fun? And it's like, you know, what are you going to do with your life? Do something that's fun, that you look forward to, that's enjoyable? Or are you just going to do something that's a punch-in 9-to-5 job? And I think it takes a special, brave person to put themselves out there and allow themselves to follow their fun. You know, in the same vein, if it's no longer fun, move on. Mm-hmm. That's my other note.
Great. Yeah. Follow your fun.
Follow your fun.
I love it. And guys, that was a long-form conversation. Thank you so much to my guest, Billy Merritt. Tune into the next episode when he, Billy Merritt, will be your host. Thank you, Billy.
Do I lie down over here?
Yes, you lie down right over there, please.
I'll wait till the next one?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Make
Good
sure.
Night.
Thank you to Alexis, our engineer. Thank you to Marla. And thank you to UCB Comedy and the UCB Theater. Thank you so much, Billy.
Thank you.
Very
thank
interesting.
You,
thanks,
a
guys.
Lot of fun.
Tune into the next one. Goodbye.
You've been listening to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and review at itunes.com/UCB Comedy. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center. Find cutting edge comedy videos on YouTube and Vimeo at UCB Comedy. Find our live shows at UCBtheater.com and connect with us on social media at UCB Comedy. This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.